Attorney Markowitz, you have somebody else's name up. Could you put your own name up, please?
Thank you.
Also, there's someone on my screen named Henry Sarugi. I don't have him on my agenda. Can you please tell me who that is? Oh, it's Wisconsin I. Okay, thank you. Usually I just see Wisconsin I. That's fine then. Thank you. Okay.
Hold, I cannot change it because I'm using my partner's Zoom.
Oh, all right. Okay, well, I know it's you because I've seen you before. So we'll work on the basis of facial recognition instead of name recognition. Before we begin, I'm going to have my marshal show you in the screen in the upper left-hand corner what the time signals look like. So when you start, you'll have a green card, say start, then a yellow card with 5 minutes, and then a red card with stop. Very good. I will hold you to the stop. I know sometimes it's hard for you to see it, so I'll let you finish your sentence or finish answering a justice's question, but we will all try to adhere to the stop. If everyone is ready to go, then I will call our first case of the day. Christus Luther versus Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Please begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General Hannah Jurs, and it is my great privilege to appear before the court today on behalf of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. In a certain way, this is an unusual case. It's an unusual eminent domain case in that we're here on a landowner's challenge opposing the government's authority to offer it more money. But when it comes to how the court resolves the legal question before it, this case is not unusual at all. It is pure statutory interpretation. And as this court well knows, when it interprets a statute, it is not looking to what a court or party believes the law should be. It's discerning what the law is, what it actually requires. And so I'd like to start with discussion of what the law actually requires here. And then I'd like to turn to why the Court of Appeals rationale, though undoubtedly well-intentioned, is fundamentally flawed and must be rejected. So let's start at the beginning with what the law actually requires.
Ms. Juris, Attorney Juris, when you're looking at what the law requires, I think this fits right into where you're starting, can you talk to me about the provision sub 2 sub B, of 32.05 that says the condemner shall provide the owner with a full narrative appraisal. And this, I keep getting stuck there because if there were items that were not part of that appraisal, how could it be a full narrative appraisal?
Sure. So I think that it's important that the court keep in mind that that full narrative appraisal is not specifically defined in the statute. Christus now, for the first time before this court, argues that that term, as Your Honor's question reflects, somehow means that if a condemnor like DOT identifies an additional damage that was not included in that appraisal, that the appraisal is somehow deficient. But what full narrative appraisal, a fair reading of that language, actually provides is that narrative means you have to explain your work, right? So it can't simply be the conclusions at the end. It has to walk through how the appraiser got to those conclusions. And full means, looping back to what the appraisal statute tells us it has to mean, is a full assessment of the property to be acquired. And so here, what's important for the court to keep in mind is that there's no question that the appraisal at issue that DOT commissioned considered all of the property to be acquired. At beyond that, Your Honor, I think it's not at all uncommon that the appraisal it's not at all uncommon that over the course of the back and forth that normally happens, that new items will become apparent that weren't apparent at the beginning. Right. So if you consider an example of, let's say, a condemnor completes Well, the condemnor requests an appraisal. The appraisal is completed. And keep in mind that the landowner does not need to speak with the condemnor's appraiser and oftentimes is not let on the property. And so let's say then that the landowner gets that appraisal and says, well, wait a minute, just as an example, I don't think your appraiser fully appreciated that the effect that this partial taking will have on my path to the tool shed on my property. So I think that warrants $300 in compensation. And the condemnor says, okay, we agree with you. That should be awarded in the jurisdictional offer. That does not mean that the appraisal upon which that offer is based isn't a full narrative appraisal because it didn't include that $300 for that path. And so this is something that happens all the time in eminent domain proceedings. That doesn't make it not a full narrative appraisal.
Well, I want to ask two follow-ups. One is you talked about the property to be acquired, but in a partial taking, isn't that the discussion of the change in the value of the property? This is not just a full, you can't just evaluate the property, the piece that got taken. It's also what's left behind. That's my first question. And my second question is, you, when you described full narrative appraisal, you talked about being able to know, to make the connection. And unfortunately, with the severance damages, there's no way of knowing where it came from. It could even be worth more than that in theory, but there's no way of knowing how that item, how they got to that number without an appraisal. So if you don't mind answering those two, and then I'll let my colleagues ask some.
Sure. And so, well, I'll start with the second question. And I think in this particular case, your Honor is right that the focus should be on, is there a discernible path from A to B? Because that's what the plain language of the statutes require, right? It uses the language is based. And so is based means, is it a found, properly means, is it a foundation? Can you see that path from A to B? In this particular case, the appraisal absolutely was the foundation for the ultimate jurisdictional offer that DOT issued. And that doesn't mean that there can't be additional items added or that DOT was improper in recognizing that just compensation required more. And the other thing I think that's important to keep in mind is that in the scenario, if the landowner has any doubts as to Your Honor's point of, well, how does the landowner know that this amount is fair? If there are any doubts, our legislature has empowered landowners to obtain their own appraisals. And so I think it's important that when we consider this, we keep in mind that there's really protection on both ends. There's the condemnor's appraisal that serves as the foundation. And then if there's any doubt that the landowner has after that, the landowner can obtain his or her own appraisal. And now I've forgotten the first part of Your Honor's question, if you could remind me.
The first part went to, I think, what the brief did and what you mentioned was kind of separate the damages from the appraisal of the property, but in a partial taking, how can you do that? When really what we're looking at is what the value after the taking versus, after the partial taking versus the value before, and that is the damages.
Sure. So I think it's important that we look at the words that the legislature has actually chosen to use at different points in this statute. I don't think anyone is disputing that an appraisal of a partial taking should include an assessment of severance damages. This appraisal did include an assessment of severance damages. And if we are looking at 3209, which is the just compensation statute that's relevant at just compensation proceedings. And if we're looking at 3209 sub 6 sub E, which talks about severance damages, it says that they need to be assessed where they're shown to exist. So I don't think anyone is saying that there will be partial takings where the proper answer to severance damages is zero, right? And so they're not always going to be there. And now going back to the point of why then it would make sense that our legislature would use the word property to be acquired, and we know property doesn't include damages because Chapter 32 defines property and that definition does not include damages, it makes sense that the legislature wouldn't create a the sort of line item requirement that the Court of Appeals has inserted here, because damages are one of the most contested issues in eminent domain. There isn't a solve for X right answer when it comes to damages. And so I think the ramifications of the Court of Appeals decision really reveals why the legislature wouldn't have inserted the requirement that the Court of Appeals has now added, because if a debate over damage amounts can nullify a jurisdictional offer, there always can be a debate over damage amounts.
Yeah, but counsel, this is a right to take suit. This is not a damages suit. And I think that there's a different foundation here with a right to take suit. At this place in the litigation, the state has to show that it had a right to take the property that it took. Mm-hmm. And it's also supposed to be dealing with the landowner so that the landowner understands what's going on. I just don't think discussion about damages is particularly helpful. I mean, you could argue that the severance damages are because DOT took something from the property of the owner. We don't describe it with meets and bounds or by acres or anything. But you can argue that there was a taking there. But to say that this appraisal that the landowner is initially supposed to accept, that's why it was provided, mystifies me when you have an appraisal that goes up by three times when you get to the jurisdictional offer. And I don't find it very helpful to redefine the word based upon. We don't need some other words to tell us what based upon means. I the case that's cited for that proposition, the difference was $30,000. This is hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm just losing your argument, frankly. Okay. This is just a right to take. Show me why DOT has a right to take, given the appraisal that was provided and the jurisdictional offer that was made.
So I agree with Your Honor that the proper question before the court should be, is the jurisdictional offer, was that based on an appraisal? Because that's the plain language. That should be the start and finish of the question. And so when we look at, as the Court of Appeals interpreted the is-based language in the Otterstatter case Your Honor referenced, we're asking, is the appraisal a supporting part, a fundamental ingredient of?
I don't like that definition, just so you know. All okay. You're doing is choosing different words, and now we'll argue about those different words. Let's just stick with what the statute says.
Okay.
Based upon. I mean, in that case, the difference was $30,000. I can see why the court chose lighter kind of words, mm-hmm. but that's not what we have here.
Mm-hmm. And so when we look at what it means for an offer to be based upon an appraisal, I think we have to keep in mind that we have a negotiation requirement, right? The condemnor has to attempt to negotiate. So that necessarily means that the appraisal will be the starting point, but it need not also be the end point. And so Your Honor is correct that the difference in dollar amount is significant in this case, but a proper reading of the based upon language shouldn't simply be a question of just a difference in dollars. Because I can give a few other examples, but
well,
there are-
Counsel, if you look at the jurisdictional offer that was over $400,000and the appraisal, how is a landowner ever to deal with those two numbers and figure out whether they got a fair jurisdictional offer? I mean, that's why you've got an appraisal there, is to give the landowner a professional view of what the property is worth. Now the DOT is so, yeah, well, I gave you that appraisal, but really we're going to pay you $400,000. Well, how do they know it's not worth $1 million? How in the world can they tell from what DOT has provided? That's what bothers me.
Yeah. Understood, Your Honor, and so I have two parts to the answer. The first part concerns what we do have in the record in this particular case. What we have in the record in this particular case is that DOT from the beginning advised Chrystus to obtain its own appraisal because this was a complex acquisition. As soon as it became clear that Chrystus had chosen not to obtain its own appraisal, DOT advised Chrystus that it would be going back and essentially re-reviewing the third-party appraisal it commissioned to ensure that everything was fully compensated. And once DOT became aware that it appeared that the appraisal had not fully compensated in certain areas, DOT brought that to Chrystus's attention.
You know, how DOT comes up with a per-acre price that's way more than the appraiser. Well, where's DOT's appraisal license? How do we know that the staffer at DOT knows what he or she is talking about? Mm-hmm. That's the purpose of the appraisal.
And so to further explain, so then the record also does reflect that that DOT explained to Chrystus that if it had any questions, if it wanted DOT to look further at particular items, to let DOT know. The record also reflects that DOT would have provided the estimates Your Honor is referring to and that work to Chrystus had it been requested. It wasn't. And then to just go beyond the facts of this particular case, again, I think we have to keep in mind that the legislature has empowered landowners if there are any residual questions when we have an increase, right? Because the condemnor has to work towards just compensation. If the landowner has any residual questions, they can obtain their own appraisal. And to add to that, Your Honor, I think it's important that the court keep in mind that our statutes specifically provide, and this is in 3205 sub 2 sub A, that the condemnor need only obtain one appraisal. And then our statutes specifically leave it to the condemnor's discretion, and the legislature uses the word discretion, whether to obtain a second. And so I think that combined with the statutory right of a landowner to obtain his or her own appraisal at a condemnor's expense really provides the protection that Your Honor is looking to. But I would stress that even if this court is somehow not satisfied of that occurring in this particular case, it's essential that the court go back to the plain language of the statute instead of the Court of Appeals rationale, which though again, undoubtedly well-intentioned, does not harmonize our statutes. It frankly implodes them. It works against the plain language of the statute in at least five significant ways. First and foremost, the Court of Appeals rationale cannot stand with the statutory requirement of negotiation, where the appraisal is the starting point and there is a requirement of negotiation on the part of the condemnor, it cannot also be the end point. Second, it reads that discretion language out of 3205 sub 2 sub A on the condemnor's part to obtain a second appraisal out and adds in a requirement that if the condemnor should determine that a damage amount that has been assessed at zero should be higher, or if a condemnor should learn whether from the landowner or through its own review that an additional item of damage is compensable. Under the Court of Appeals rationale, then the condemnor would be statutorily required to obtain a second appraisal. Third, and we've already discussed this a bit, it conflates the term property and damages. And as noted, I don't think anyone is disagreeing that that severance damages should be assessed in an appraisal of a partial taking, but nowhere in our statutes will this court find anything that says that if the jurisdictional offer is relying on an appraisal And if the jurisdictional offer assesses a higher damage amount or adds compensation for a damage not present in the appraisal, that somehow invalidates the jurisdictional offer that is based on that appraisal. The Court of Appeals decision also gums up the distinction between the right to take track, as Your Honor noted, we're under the right to take track, and the separate just compensation track. I think to illustrate why that's problematic, consider if in this same circumstance, instead of assessing a zero at severance damages, the appraisal the DOT commission instead assessed severance damages at $100. And then DOT performed the same review, ultimately determined that we think it's significantly higher. Well, there's no meaningful distinction between those two scenarios under the plain language of the statutes. But from that, we can see that what the Court of Appeals really is doing is inputting a just compensation debate into a right to take procedure. And lastly, the Court of Appeals decision reads words out of the jurisdictional offer statute. And when we look at the jurisdictional offer statute, and that's 3205 sub 3, I encourage the court to look at 3205 sub 3 sub D and juxtapose that with 3205 sub 3 sub E. Sub 3 sub E contains the is-based language that we're here to talk about today. And that language says that when a condemnor like DOT issues its jurisdictional offer, it must make available an appraisal upon which its offer is based. 3205 sub 3 sub D separately states that the jurisdictional offer itself must provide a list of compensation, quote, itemized as to the items of damage set forth in section 3209, 3209 being the just compensation statute. Under the Court of Appeals rationale, that language in 3D would be superfluous because the appraisal would have that exact same line item of damages. And so I think that that distinction is an important recognition that from our legislature that we have to have a process of negotiation. There will be increases. There will be things that will be added. That does not make an appraisal necessarily defective or insufficient under the plain language of the statute.
It certainly would make it very difficult to understand, don't you think? How would you ever compare the current appraisal with a jurisdictional offer that's three times greater and different in many, many, many respects from the foundational per acreage difference? I mean, why even have an appraisal in the statute if it isn't going to be helpful to the parties in addressing what just compensation is?
Well,
I know it's discretionary with DOT, but I frankly don't see how they got where they got unless they have an in-person appraiser. And if they do, well, fine, I guess they do. But it doesn't help the landowner figure out whether the right to take obligation has been satisfied.
Well, and I think, Your Honor, that we do have also in this record, right, the chart where DOT provided those point-by-point comparisons. So landowner does have that. But I think Your Honor's questions really go to what is the proper definition of is based, which is, can the landowner see how we got from point A to point B?
And I
would just stress that I don't think it's as simple as saying that should be a question of difference in dollars. And so let me give you just another example. Let's say that there is a partial taking of a small slice of farmland, and the condemnor obtains the appraisal. Landowner doesn't speak with the condemnor's appraiser, and the condemnor's appraiser assesses the land at only a few thousand dollars. But now the landowner receives that appraisal, and says, well, wait a minute. Yes, that land might not be worth much, but our entire underground irrigation system is the pump operates right under that piece of land. Mm-hmm. I've spoken to the person who installed that system. It's going to cost $50,000, $100,000 to replace that system. Mm-hmm. And the so the landowner communicates that to the condemnor. The condemnor says, we agree it needs to be compensated in that way. Under the Court of Appeals rationale, there would need to be an entire new appraisal. But we see why that wouldn't be necessary in that scenario, because the landowner fully assesses how we got from A to B. And there would simply be no need to obtain another appraisal. And I would also note that because damages are not a simple solve for X, it's not as if DOT could somehow just essentially coerce an appraiser into agreeing with it. But DOT does have a statutory and constitutional responsibility to provide what it believes to be just compensation. And we should want condemnors to do exactly what DOT did. And again, if there are any lingering doubts that the landowner has, the landowner is able to obtain his or her own appraisal.
Now, so one of your arguments, I thought, in the alternative too, on the severance damages piece in particular, was that in fact they were included, that there was initial determination that there weren't any, and here there were some. So suppose this court didn't agree with you that the severance damages didn't need to be included. I think your argument, if I understand it correctly, is still that you might succeed simply because they were included. There just was a determination there were no damages, which might impact the hypothetical you just gave there as well.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. When we look at the appraisal here, the appraiser did, and I see my time has expired. May I briefly?
You can finish answering Justice Hagedorn's question. Yes, please.
The appraisal specifically stated and considered severance damages, and it concluded that they were not shown to exist. That aligns with the language of 3209 that says severance damages are applicable where shown to exist. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Attorney Markowitz, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, thank you very much, Your Honor.
Okay, please do.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'd like to begin with a very brief introduction. With me in this virtual courtroom, which is a brand new experience for me, are my partners, Smita Chittamaneni and Adam Bazelon. I want to express my thanks to them and also to my partner, Andrea Roschke, as well as to those who have provided amicus briefs in support of our client's position. But I'm saving a special thanks to our client for standing up not only on behalf of the congregation, but for all Wisconsin property owners. Because this case is about keeping the eminent domain playing field at a level which is fair to property owners, who invariably find themselves confronted with an involuntary taking of some or all of their property by an entity which cannot be simply turned away. Based on my experience, I'd just like to briefly review what should be happening in the eminent domain process and which got lost in the shuffle here. It begins with an authentication of need for a particular public purpose by the condemnor. It then results in the creation of a plan to implement the authenticated need by the condemnor. We then get to the need to measure the amount of just compensation to be paid to each affected owner. That is not to be done by the condemnor, but instead by a qualified appraiser whose work product is then delivered to the condemnor, whose role simply should be to ascertain whether that appraisal meets the requirements of our law, not to be altered to support the condemnor's partisan view of the matter. when the condemnor has an appraisal which meets the legal requirements, the condemnor can then provide it to the property owner. Offers then made by the condemnor must rest on the foundation of the appraisal. Once that happens, the owner is at the owner's starting point. Here's where I am. What do I think? How do I proceed? Do I accept? Do I negotiate? Do I hire an appraiser? Do I do all of the other things that the statute contemplates? In this case, which is now before the court, the procedural train left the tracks. When DOT decided to ignore its own appraisal and substitute its own partisan judgment for an admittedly flawed appraisal.
Mr. Markowitz, can you address Justice Hagedorn's question that he had just asked Ms. Juris at the end, that there really potentially was a discussion of severance damages? It didn't come out of nowhere. It just wasn't able to be ascertained according to the appraiser. And so therefore, that item was addressed in the appraisal. How do you respond to that?
Appraisers frequently will say things like, I looked at the different approaches. I looked at the cost approach. I looked at the income approach. I looked at the market approach. And I concluded that I would just use the market approach. In this case, if you read the words in the appraiser says there were no severance damages. He doesn't say, I considered it and didn't consider it relevant to the matter. He said, I considered it and concluded there were no severance damages. What?
Counsel?
I think he needs to finish the answer. Just one second.
I think I've answered the question.
Okay. All right. Very good. Please, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley.
Counsel, you twice made reference to the condemnor's partisan judgment. So I quickly pick up the non-party brief of the American Transmission Company. I'm not sure what partisan judgment they have, or the electric power company or the gas company. I am totally at a loss as to what partisan judgment they have. They may have, they may not have. But on page 19 of the American Transmission Company brief, and I note that I think these folks are involved in a lot of condemnation. The very top of the page, on page 19, they assert that the omission of damages from an appraisal is a compensation issue, not a right to take issue. And they cite to paragraph 33 of the Otterstatter's case. Now, I know there has been some questions about the two tracks and that this is a right to take track. But can you respond to the assertion of the American Transmission Company that omission of damages from an appraisal is a compensation issue and not a right to take issue?
Well, thank you for the question. I believe there is really only one true track, and that is what is directed by our Constitution, which says that private property cannot be taken for public purposes without just compensation. How we get to the just compensation issue correctly in this state begins with a bona fide appraisal and a bona fide offer by the condemnor. There is no way a property owner who is not steeped in the nuances of statutory interpretation can really deal with the situation. Whether it's a farmer, whether it's a homeowner, whether it's a businessman, the first thing in the door is, we're here to make you an offer to acquire what we need for your property. Everyone explains to that farmer, that resident, that business owner, that Wisconsin is committed to providing just compensation. That's what is supposed to be readable out of that appraisal report.
Mr. Markowitz, can I ask you a question? Just going from that point, it's my understanding that if, in this case, Christus disagreed with the first appraisal or they didn't think that it included the severance damages, that they could have asked for a second appraisal and had DOT pay for that. Is that correct?
They had a right to do so. But, Justice, I think that the issue here is who's the burden on? The burden is not on the property owner to fight their way through this morass of the threat against the property. It's up to the government in this case, or the utility in the case that Justice Bradley referred to show the property owner what is the playing field. What are we talking about here?
No, and I understand that, and it looks to me like that may have happened here, and that the appraiser in the first appraisal said we weren't able to assess these severance damages. Help me understand the burden of getting a second appraisal. I'm not sure I'm wrapping my head around why that is such. I'm not saying it's not a big burden on your client. I'm just not understanding your argument. Help me understand that.
The responsibility to get a second appraisal is limited by statute. The property owner is told if you get it and submit it to us within 60 days, we will take it into consideration. In fact, we'll even reimburse you for the cost of doing that. When you get into a complicated condemnation, which this one is, it is very unusual for anyone to be able to react that quickly. By the time it is reviewed by someone else, the 60 days is frequently gone by. But I'd like to just point out what could and should have occurred here. When DOT received that appraisal, obviously the very people who felt it appropriate to make changes in amounts later were also in a position to evaluate the appraisal. Once they were satisfied that the appraisal was so far off the mark, and the record is very clear that they had that appraisal by the 1st of October of 2016, that jurisdictional offer was not made until April of 17. There was a very long period of time in there in which DOT could have said, you know, our appraisal really doesn't hit the mark. We need to get a new appraisal. But the question that you may wish to ask is, why did DOT not do so? Why did they just steam ahead? It's because it gave them an advantage in further dealings with the property owner. In effect, it allows DOT to tilt the field against the church. I'd just like to take a couple of minutes and point out what the actual advantage is that is created for the condemnor under the situation of this case. First, if the owner accepts that appraisal that was given him in the first place and comes back and says, I accept, you have what we've described in our brief as a miscarriage of justice, because DOT admits it should be much, much higher. What the property owner has, if they don't believe that this is correct, is a single time-limited remedy under 3205 sub 5. This right to take challenge, which the court has spent a great deal of time over recent years clarifying when it needs to be applied, and this is one of those cases when it needs to be applied, that has to be initiated within 40 days of the jurisdictional offer. Now, the condemnor can go to award at any time the condemnor wishes. They don't have to do it within 20 days or 40 days or 60 days. The statute allows the condemnor to go to award at any time that they wish. The owner has no right to appeal and get into this just compensation issue until the award has been filed. Now, what happens if the owner does not appeal? then the amount is grounded on a flawed procedure. Or, and this is where I really feel the pain that occurs on the property owner's side. The case proceeds to trial. The owner appeals. Now we're in trial. At the trial setting, the DOT can put forward this flawed appraisal. And the property owner has no means whatsoever to be able to point out to the jury that DOT didn't even use its own appraisal. They paid triple that amount when they got around to paying the amount that they believe was a correct amount of just compensation.
Counsel?
They're very familiar with the statute that there's absolutely no way under our system in which the jury can be informed as to what was paid. The jury can't be told what was the jurisdictional offer, can't be told what the amount of the award was, can't be told what the amount of the payment was.
Counsel, before we get to trial, though, the property owner does have some things it can do under the statute. It isn't just standing by watching what the government is doing in this case, right? The owner could have obtained an appraisal at the government's expense, and the property owner also can try to negotiate and say, look, we think your appraisal is low, and here's why. Did you look at these aspects of the property that is proposed to be taken before, did you take that into account in creating the appraisal? So there are things the property owner could do. It doesn't seem like your client did that in this case. Could you respond to that?
Yes, thank you. The property owner could respond, but the property owner is under no obligation to respond. And let me take one of your examples, Justice. Let's assume that after the award is made, after the jurisdictional offer and the award is made, the property owner gets an appraisal. And the appraisal says, I'm going to use the chief's $1 million. DOT may or may not reopen negotiations and get into discussion. This is not about what might have happened. It's what really should have happened in this case. DOT could receive that appraisal and say, well, we don't buy that. We're sticking with our original position. Our original position is the amount that we paid you. Unfortunately, that position cannot be made known to the jury. The jury may hear the case, and the jury may hear that flawed appraisal testify to approximately $133,000. And again, using the example, hear the property owner expert testify that it should be $1 million. In my experience, juries do not frequently accept one position or the other. They try to find something which they conceive as reasonable. So the
Attorney Markowitz, can I ask a question about that part in your brief? Is there something, in the rules of evidence that says a judge may not allow the amount of the jurisdictional offer to be offered in a jury trial?
Yes, Your Honor. It's not a rule of evidence. It's in the statute. 3205 sub 11 says under no circumstances can the jury be informed as to the amount that was paid. One of the ways to address this in a legislative setting as to how to better master our system and make it fair for all parties might be for the legislature to change 3205 sub 11 and allow the jury to understand exactly what was paid. As we discuss it today, it's pretty obvious that DOT discarded that appraisal. So DOT now goes into a piece of litigation in which the only evidence they may have is that very flawed appraisal. That is why this problem needs to be solved at the outset, not along the way. This problem needs to be focused on under 3205 sub 5. just like this court ruled years ago that an absence of good faith negotiation is so fundamental that it requires the process to be restarted. This is in that same vein. DOT, neither DOT or any condemnor should be permitted to discard its own appraisal and then to endorse and present it for strategic purposes. Certainly not a position which has omitted statutory elements and is triple the amount that the appraisal included in the first place. There is a solution to this problem. The solution to this problem is for this court to say to every condemnor in the state, you must follow the rules. You must apply the rules in every case, and you must apply it all of the time. Thank you very much. That completes my argument, other than responding to any further questions that members of the court may have. I do want to end, if I've got a couple of minutes, with just a personal note. I look back to see the first time that I appeared before this court, and it was in November of 1959. One of my partners asked me if I ever would have imagined addressing the court in the manner in which the court is being addressed today. And I can assure you that would have been beyond my wildest imagination back then. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Rebuttal, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. A few points that I'd like to emphasize. I think it's important to keep in mind that our statutes, as this court has recognized, are designed to encourage negotiation and encourage resolution without the need for litigation. And so that the ultimate goal of the jurisdictional offer is to ensure just compensation. And so within that, DOT here did exactly what we want condemnors to be doing. And that's ensuring just compensation without the need for litigation.
Attorney Juris,
is there some reason that's in the record that says why DOT, when they found this appraisal was not anywhere near accurate, didn't just get another appraisal? Is there anything in the record? If there's not, then just say there's not.
No, there's not. But okay. I think the plain language of the statute reflects that they don't need to. And
I understand your argument. I just thought maybe, never mind. That's fine. You answered the question. Thank you.
Attorney Juris, would you respond to Attorney Markowitz's answer to my question about the jurisdictional offer never being disclosed in a trial? And he pointed me to 3205 sub 11. And I do see that about four, five, six, it's a long section, a number of sentences in, it does say that the amount of the jurisdictional offer or basic award shall not be disclosed to the jury during such trial. I think it was either in one of your briefs or maybe it was one of the amicus briefs, they disagreed with what he said. What's your position on that?
Well, we don't dispute that the jurisdictional offer itself is not admissible. What's key is the opportunity to obtain additional appraisals. That continues, right? There would be nothing that would prevent obtaining additional appraisals before trial or in preparation for trial. And again, what's critical here is that the goal of the jurisdictional offer and the very reason that DOT is doing what it did is to avoid the need for litigation in trial. And so I think that goes to Your Honor's question and Justice Rebecca Bradley's question, that it's important when we're considering what the statutes require of a condemnor, that the court also consider what the legislature has provided for the landowner in terms of tools to ensure sufficient understanding. And it makes sense that you would have the condemnor's appraisal that needs to serve as the foundation, as the starting point, and then you would have the protection on the back end that if the landowner has any doubts, that they can obtain their own appraisal.
Isn't it a little odd, counsel, just thinking about this big picture, I mean, there's some appeal to the Court of Appeals conclusion that severance should at least have a say here. And I understand your position that it was presented and then there was a conclusion was there was none offered. But you're also arguing that you don't need to say anything about severance. And I understand there's a two-track thing going on here, but it'd be odd to say, or maybe it would be odd to say, it doesn't matter whether we include any severance, even though we know that we need to include that in order to pay you justly. We don't need to include anything about that. We can just ignore that whole piece when we're giving you the appraisal on which our negotiations will commence. There does seem to be some connection between those two that the Court of Appeals is identifying. I wonder if you could respond to that.
Sure. I think there is, as noted, I don't think anyone's disputing that from a best practices standpoint, it makes sense to have that included. That is a different question from whether our statutes in any way provide that a condemnor's inclusion of additional compensation for damages or a line item of damage that was not included in the appraisal upon which its offer is based. There's not anything in our statute that says that that invalidates the jurisdictional offer. And that makes sense because damages are such a point of contention. And
so if it's known, would you think there'd be any requirement to say it? I mean, if you know you're taking, you know, a parking lot that's going to render a property having no parking, you wouldn't just, you know, an appraisal wouldn't normally just value the value of that small provision. It would value how much that affects the rest of the property as part of its appraisal. Wouldn't that be normal?
May I answer?
Yes, of course. Please answer his question.
Yes, it makes sense that should be included, but we have to look at the plain language of what the legislature actually requires. And that recognition makes sense when we consider the chronological procedure of the negotiation back and forth and how this statutory scheme works. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And thank you both very much for participating in oral argument in this format. Attorney Markowitz, I think everybody on the court is surprised that this is the way we are doing argument, but actually the attorneys have done a wonderful job of informing the court, participating, and answering all of our questions. So I'm very encouraged about the support we've had from the bar, and I think all the justices on the court would echo the same thing. We are going to adjourn now, and the court will meet in closed conference at, 5 minutes to 11. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.